Oh, I'm sorry. Did I break your concentration?
G'day world, it's Wednesday the 27th of June 2007. You're listening to Cameron Riley on the Podcast Network. My guest today from another part of Melbourne, very unusually, we have a local person on the show. Dr. Michael Georgeff is an artificial intelligence guru from around the world, is now serving in the Faculty of Medicine as the director of the eHealth Research Unit at Monash University. Welcome to the show, Dr. Mike.
Hi, Cameron.
Now, you had a very long and illustrious career. I've been reading in my research, you were the program director at the Artificial Intelligence Center at Stanford Research Institute, SRI. You also had a lot to do with NASA's space shuttle missions and the AI on the space shuttles. That must have been an exciting line of work for a while.
Yes, it was. It was very interesting, in part because I actually started my career in traditional aerospace, got more and more involved in the computers we were using to do our fluid dynamics modeling, and then became interested in how we could get computers to think and think rationally and reason and about the world and how to achieve their objectives and goals. And went right away from the notion of ever being able to get close to the shuttle, which had been one of the loves of my childhood. And then when I went to work at Stanford, one of the first opportunities that came up was that the ESA was having enormous problems trying to keep the shuttles flying. In other words, they would... the astronauts would spend up to 80% of their time rectifying faults on the shuttle as they occurred in flight. So they weren't getting any of their experiments done, and the cost of the astronauts was then $50,000 an hour, which would be worth considerably more now. So, and they couldn't, conventional computing technology wasn't able to help. So we designed for NASA what we called a goal-directed intelligence system, which instead of having to tell it exactly what to do, which given the complexity of the shuttles was the hard thing, we simply had to tell the computer what objectives or goals we wanted it to achieve, and then it would reason itself how to rectify the fault and what actions to do. So in one sense, it was like, if anyone remembers 2001, it was like the first miniature HAL on board the space shuttle. So, and it was, for me particularly, coming full circle back to work on it was fantastic.
So you must have felt pretty involved when they have issues with the shuttles, when ceramic tiles fall off and that kind of thing.
Yes, it's interesting in that obviously the problems that are disastrous tend to be ones that are not IT problems. In fact, in one sense, you would expect that the IT problems would have come up and been the things that have caused disasters. But it turns out that it's all the more normal engineering, physical stuff that's caused all those disasters. And the computer systems have been, despite the fact that they've been constrained to such tiny processes and things like that, the computer systems have been fantastic by and large. But it has been a problem from the start on the shuttle. Is so many complexities, so many things can go wrong, and for a small group of astronauts, even though they're backed up by mission control, just to be able to handle all the different factors is extremely hard without really intelligent computer support.
Absolutely. And things like valves and cooling rings and ceramic tiles are a little bit beyond the domain of HAL, really, aren't they?
Yeah, that's right. So HAL's good at thinking about things, but not terribly good at actually doing anything.
Did you ever have to get your AI systems to control pod bay doors or anything like that?
to say that again, sorry.
Did any of your AI systems you developed for NASA have to control pod bay doors?
No, we didn't actually have to open any pod bay doors. And in fact, the astronauts had wised up since hell, and every action had to be authorized by the astronauts. So our system never had the complete control that HAL had.
All right, good thinking there. Now, in the late 90s, you founded a software company, Agentis International. Tell us a little bit about Agentis.
So Agentis was, or is, a company that took the ideas from that we had about the so-called goal-directed systems and applied it to business areas such as Fortune 500 companies. So the idea here is that just like on the shuttle, where you're trying to automate really complex business processes, in large companies, they often have very complex business processes to automate. So, for example, one of Agentis's customers is DHL. And DHL have enormously complex processes for trying to manage the tracking, billing, and delivery of packages worldwide, particularly if it goes over national borders, and each jurisdiction has different rules and regulations and pricing and so on. So it's extremely complex, and this is typical of many businesses. So Agentis idea from the space shuttle that if we had used goal-directed, what we call software agents or intelligent agents, if we could use goal-directed agents so that instead of having to explicitly code all the processes involving these complex rules, if we could just write down the rules and then use these goal-directed agents to work out when to apply those rules and in what circumstances, there was the opportunity to dramatically change the amount of coding effort to build these sort of systems. And indeed, there's also the opportunity to do things that were really beyond the reach of conventional computing just because they were too complex to build and too expensive. So it proved that, so Agentis took that technology and it proved that could develop applications such as the one I've described in about 20% of the time. In fact, in some cases, we could develop in 10% of the time that it took using conventional programming. So effectively, we were saving 80% of the development costs for putting in these sort of applications. And also the maintenance was hugely, an ongoing support was even more greatly reduced because if ever the rules changed, you simply went in and told the computer what the new story was, and it would work out for itself, you know, how to use this and in what circumstance to use it. So effectively, it was a transfer of the same goal-directed technology that Agentis applied in the business domain.
Sounds like a more advanced version of some of the business process re-engineering software that I used to sell back in my Microsoft days 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah, I think it. You know, in fact, you know, some of the original work we did was driven by process re-engineering ideas, and if you look at the literature on process re-engineering and a lot of the methodologies, they all, you know, are around the setting of specifying objectives and goals for the business and then specifying the situations in which you should do certain things. And the problem is with conventional code, by the time you actually write it in code, all those things like objectives and situations have all been reduced to code, so they never appear. So what it really means is that we were trying to say, look, you need to program the computer so that the computer itself is always reasoning about what it's trying to achieve, rather than you having to program it. And so, to give you a very simple example, a human, if I come home to try and from work and try and get into the house, I'll go to the front door and I'll try and open it, and if it doesn't open because someone's locked it, then I'll put my hand in my pocket to get my keys out, and then I might discover my keys aren't in my pocket because I've left them back in the car, so I'll go back to the car and grab the keys, and then I try and unlock the door and that doesn't work, and so I'll walk around the back of the house, climb in an open window or whatever. But doing that, if I had to try and program that sort of activity, it would be exceptionally hard. But if I can program in terms of objectives and goals, then it becomes very simple, because at the end of the day, the thing that's driving you as a human is that you have the goal to get into the house. And if instead of trying to program the whole scenario from start to end, if I could just give you a whole lot of rules, if you like, about different ways of getting in the house, such as, well, one way to get in the house is to go in the back window. Another way to get in the house is to open the front door. If your goal is to open the door, one way is to turn the handle. Another way is to unlock it. If I just gave you all that information and then you decide how you used it, it becomes much simpler, because you're just feeding in information about different ways to achieve objectives, and then you let the human, or in case the computer, then try and piece those bits and pieces together depending on whatever objectives it has. So it makes the computer able to generate very complex scenarios and activities based on really some very simple principles.
You know, it sounds fascinating, but I guess when most people think of AI or artificial intelligence, we think of HAL. We don't think of agent-based software for business process management. What do you think happened to AI in the last 20 years that's taken us away from HAL? Or have we stepped away from HAL?
So, well, as it turns out, I think in the minds of most AI researchers, there is always HAL in the background. But as we have, as we've tried to solve specific problems, for example, you discover that it would be good to see, or be good if the computer could talk or understand natural language. As you drive down into those specific areas, then you start to get more and more specialized in those particular areas. And in particular, it's often in those specialized areas that the biggest wins have occurred from a commercial point of view. So the work on speech understanding has immediate commercial value, and the work on a lot of work in vision then turned into work on representing three-dimensional objects and things, which had a huge commercial impact in video games. So in one sense, a lot of AI, the broad vision, became more specialized, it got more esoteric and harder to understand for the normal person. But those more specialized applications tended to have more commercial value than bringing along another HAL. You know, in part because HALs are reasonably powerful entities, and it's until they get really good, you're not normally going to introduce them into your business. So it's not as commercial a proposition to produce HALs, I guess.
Do you think 20 years ago, if you'd had to project where AI would be in 2007, you would have had an accurate stab at it, or was everyone wildly off 20 years ago?
20 years ago, I think they were actually pretty But I think everyone had, by 20 years ago, everyone had gone through the AI winter and realized that all the things that we thought back in the late 60s, early 70s, the things that we thought were possible, I think by the, you know, the late 80s, people had realized that things were really, despite early successes that actually really looked terrific, one discovered that they were really hard to get to a level of real understanding, you know, the machine trying to get to really understand its environment that was in and to really act in a reasoned way was much, much harder than we ever thought. And so by the late 80s, I think people had realized that. So I think in the late 80s, if you'd predicted where it would go, I think you would have been pretty close. I think the big change has probably been the internet, the growth of which would have surprised everyone. And then, you know, and then things like, which are now starting to emerge, like Second Life and some of those things would have, I don't think people would have predicted the range of, I guess not the range, it's really how many people would be starting to use IT technologies. I think we would have under-predicted that dramatically. But in terms of where AI has got, I think we would have been pretty spot on.
Okay. Now, you're doing a lot of work with your role at Monash around, as we said before, e-health. I've read a little bit about your idea for something you've been calling the health web. What do you see as being the opportunity for information technology in the health industry at the moment?
So health's a very interesting area because it's if you look at any other industry and you look at the primary most important transactions that go on in that industry, in almost every industry those transactions are electronically mediated one way or another. In health, if you look at health, the most important transactions are things like sending referrals to doctors, getting prescriptions filled, discharge summaries from hospitals, pre-admission to hospitals. Those transactions are hugely crucial. If a GP doesn't, if a doctor doesn't get a message from the hospital, the drugs that the patient is being put on, then it's likely that the patient will be given, you know, contraindicating drugs and end up either back in hospital or losing limbs or, in the worst case, dead. And so enormous number of adverse drug events occur because of the fact that these communications aren't handled effectively. And what happens in healthcare, almost none of those transactions are handled electronically. In fact, many of them aren't even delivered by fax. In fact, most of them are still being delivered by hand. You know, you get the doctor gives the patient a prescription and the patient then takes that bit of paper and wanders down to the pharmacy. And similarly, the patient takes a bit of paper, which is a referral, now, which could be happening months later, and somehow is expected not to lose it or whatever, and then hand delivers it to the doctor at the other end. So, and then discharge summaries from hospitals. It's, I think the average in Australia is something like 6 to 8 weeks before the communication, between when the communication, the patient's been in hospital and when the doctor receives notification. So half the time, doctors don't even know patients have been into hospital. So there's a huge lack of connectivity, you know, basic connectivity in the in healthcare. And if you look at why this has happened, it's quite, I think, instructive as how IT has been introduced into health. health has always been somewhat of a cottage industry, with every individual doing their own. And the major health departments, by and large, have tried to bring that under control. And where they have used automation, they've tried to do it in the way that you do it in a bank. That is, they've really focused on automating systems within hospitals, and they've focused on putting desktop applications on a doctor's desk. So very siloed applications, very focused on particular things that the hospital or the GP does already, and tries to automate those tasks. But almost no one in healthcare has really considered, well, look, the fundamental problem here is it's all siloed. You know, you've got to take care of people with chronic disease or others. You really have a whole network of people that are involved. The fact that each of these is working in silos is the fundamental problem, and connectivity is the fundamental thing that's missing. So instead of trying to build siloed applications, we should really be focusing on getting this connectivity going. And, you know, in the old world, that would have been a hard task. But in today's world, with the internet going and with kids sharing music files across the world, it's totally bizarre that in healthcare, we can't even share patients' clinical data around a care team. So in health, that's what my main focus has been, trying to change the paradigm from this industrial enterprise model of health to one that health is really part of the knowledge economy. And we need, just like connectivity is so important to the economy, connectivity, and particularly broadband internet connectivity, where we've focused on getting, you know, just getting connected. Don't worry too much about what data is actually flowing. Just get ourselves connected. My aim has been trying to make the healthcare industry change its framework for viewing information technology.
It reminds me of a video that Microsoft had produced back in about 2000, I think. And you may have seen this, but it involves a guy who gets hit by a bike in the middle of the street. He's out of town, and he pulls out his mobile phone, says, "Call Dr. Jones," says to the doctor, "You know, I've just been in an accident." The doctor looks at his or her PC and says, "Well, I can see from the mobile phone data that you're in this suburb. Let me check all of the availabilities of the doctors within that area. Okay, I can see one that's got some free time in the schedule. I'll book you in there. They'll be expecting you in 10 minutes. He goes to the doctor there and gets an X-ray, which gets sent electronically back to his own personal doctor in his hometown, who's looking at the X-ray in real time when it's done digitally, and says, "Okay, well, I agree with the prognosis, and we're going to send you for some painkillers. I see on your electronic file that you're allergic to painkiller A, so I'm going to prescribe painkiller B. I've ordered that for you. It's going to be waiting for you at the chemist, which is a block around the corner, the maps on your mobile phone." All that kind of stuff, which was a great vision, but I think we're still a long way away from that today.
Yeah, and so I think you're right. It's the idea of a connected health system where you share information around the health system has been there for a while, but I think one of the problems has been that a vision like the Microsoft vision, number one, is it's very hard to get those things off the ground because they're different from normal practice, right? So it's a huge change practice issue to try and get people to start operating in that world. And also because to try and get things at that level going requires enormous investment. And the typical approach has been, you know, so for example, it was early on recognized that if we had a single large centralized database of all the patient's information, then everyone could log into that, see what was wrong with the patient, and we'd avoid lots of problems. But to build such an electrical turned out to be much more expensive than one thought, and then you had to agree on standards and how you're going to represent the data and how was and so on. So my view is the problem is that by focusing on too much on those applications, everything became too expensive. And I think the key is to approach it like we did the internet. I mean, the internet, we really just focused on connectivity and browsers, in a sense, in the early days. We didn't worry about the applications that sat on top of it. And the way it was funded was, while the government funded the core infrastructure, private industry and different regions each funded their bit of it. So my view is that we really need to just go back to really fundamental internet-like basics. We really just should focus on the simple things that I mentioned, like discharge summaries and referrals. If we could just focus on getting those all transmitted electronically, we don't require any practice change. The information is already there in the GP's desktop and in the hospital. It's just no one's put in the bit of wire, and by the bit of wire I really mean the technologies that enable those things to flow from one party to the other.
Is it as simple as email in the first instance?
I beg your pardon?
Is it as simple as email in the first instance?
It's almost as simple as email. You know, you have to make sure the other person actually opened it and read it. So you have these so-called non-repudiation things that you need to put in place. And I guess the problem with email is, because it's all point-to-point, it complicates sharing that information. So, but it's not... basically, what it requires is a more... a web-based, service-based architecture so that... if I send a discharge summary out, it goes to all the appropriate people, and indeed any software application that wants to pick that information up can pick it up. So it really needs is some sort of what in business would be called an enterprise services bus, or some sort of middleware infrastructure, so most of the traffic goes through that infrastructure and then can be picked up by anyone that is authorised to see it, rather than just point to point. But apart from that small technical issue, it's effectively just sending everything by email would be better than what they're doing at the moment.
I seem to recall that 3 or 4 years ago, the health departments around the country spent hundreds of millions of dollars buying very expensive software systems that were going to deliver a lot of this. Did that get rolled out? What happened?
So some good things have happened. The Australian government at least put a lot of money into getting general practice doctors to computerise. And so I think for most people now in Australia, you would the uptake of that has been enormous. I think around 90% of doctors are now computerized, and so they, as most people will be aware, prescriptions, referrals are usually, instead of being handwritten now, are usually typed up by the GP or their assistant. And so they do use these computers for, and more are using to enter information, clinical notes and all of that. So that part's been successful. Of course, the one bit that they haven't done is do any of the connectivity. So it still just all sits there in silos. And I should say the same with home monitoring. So most people with diabetes have these home monitors which can upload information into their PC or into their mobile phone. But that's as far as it gets. You know, none of that is connected anywhere. So you've got all the... You've still got... all these, despite all the computerization we've done, we've just left it sitting, you know, on the guy's desk. So the connectivity part has been completely missing. The other part, the government or Commonwealth also spent a lot of money trying to pursue this electronic health, a national electronic health record. and there, I don't think they went very far. And I think, and the issues there are really, like I said before, it's the electronic health record by itself doesn't directly add much business value. It's actually, again, it's the thing that adds business value is all the connectivity. So trying to reach agreement on what this electronic health record should be was, a lot of money was spent, but it was really premature. And then in the last few years, the government has come around to understanding that connectivity is really key. So a number of the initiatives they now have in the broadband area are starting to move to promoting connectivity in health rather than these siloed applications.
There's actually a federal program, isn't there, called Broadband for Health, where they're trying to push broadband out to regional GPs and Aboriginal community health services and these sorts of places?
Yes, and I think that that promises to be, I think, if it's done right, could be really successful. And even particularly in Indigenous communities. So, for example, one of the things I'm looking at is within Aboriginal communities, there's very little data on that keeps track of the health of the community. And in particular, a lot of Aborigines suffer diabetes, but their records, you know, every time some new doctor or new nurse or the remote nurse or doctor comes into the village or into the community, it's they almost start off from scratch again because it's very hard to keep track of the health status of the people with chronic disease. And people are, and sometimes they're not there when a nurse comes and so forth. So simply by using IT to start tracking the health events of people in remote and Indigenous communities offers the opportunity to really dramatically improve their healthcare. And then if you add to that telemedicine, so their eyes can be, for example, photographed, and that can be shipped electronically to an eye institute in Perth, instead of making, you know, half the community travel down to, you know, thousands of kilometres to Perth to get their eyes examined there. If we could do that using telemedicine, you know, the young kids in most of those communities, at least the ones that are covered by mobile coverage, they all run around with mobiles. We could start to use, you know, pay them to go around and take blood glucose measurements from, you know, all the people in the community that have diabetes. And so then the young kids would actually become paramedics. They'd start to learn IT skills, and you'd start to create some industries in those communities. So I have a strong belief that starting to introduce IT technologies into Indigenous communities to do useful things could be really fantastic for the, not only for the health of the individuals, but also for getting some industry and income into those communities.
Do you think lives are being lost because we don't have this connectivity sorted out?
Well, it's absolutely certain that lives have been lost. We know, for example, in Australia that if we better chronically ill people and helped them to adhere to their care plans, we know that we could reduce hospital admissions by between 30% and 50%. We know just in hospitals alone in Australia that 9,000 people a year die from preventable adverse events. So 9,000 people a year is, I think, a couple of jumbo jets a month of people just disappearing that need not have, who need not have died. And when you look at the reasons for most of that, and in a very significant number of those through communication errors of one sort or another. So I'm not saying connectivity would solve all those problems, but it's a bit like the introduction of safety belts in car accidents. Getting the right information to the right people at the right time in healthcare is absolutely fundamental to the whole business. If you don't know what drugs people are on, then you're definitely going to have a high chance of giving them a drug to which they're allergic. And, you know, apart from the deaths, the severe allergies make your arms and legs fall off. So there are, you know, people who unnecessarily lose limbs just because someone has given them the wrong drug. Mm. So it will make a huge difference, not immediately, but once you get connectivity happening, then with the right incentives, businesses will start to plug in IT applications and services that start helping people with plans, that start reminding people of the drugs that they're on are dangerous and things like that.
And we keep reading about the potential threats of a major epidemic, things like avian bird flu, etc. And, you know, I imagine that having a system like this up and running before one of those things hits could save millions of lives.
Yes, it would. I mean, there are some interesting things there that actually go beyond health. It's, in some of those cases, of course, it's actually the animals you get the early warning signs from. And even there, there are, in Australia, a lot of the health status of animals is already electronically tracked pretty well. But in combination, I mean, you're absolutely right. Just purely, even if we just restrict it to humans, signs of outbreaks of flu and salmonella and all of these things, would make a big difference. How big, I don't know. And certainly if that was extended into the veterinary area, then you would have a lot of opportunity for early warning of these sorts of outbreaks.
Is this an issue that any of the political parties in this country seem to be handling well? I noticed that in the news today, yesterday I think it was, there was this announcement that Boston Consulting has been engaged to do a review of the National E-Health Transition Authority. But I don't hear any of the political parties really talking about the need for stepping up e-health and making it a reality sooner. Am I just not reading the right articles, or is it something that's not on the top of their radar screens?
I think it's happening incrementally rather than being seen as a major opportunity. And I think there are a couple of reasons for that. So one of the... it's certainly the case that there's the government has in the past put a ton of money into e-health, such as the Health Connect project, and had very poor results despite the promises that everyone made. And because of that, and because of it was clear that interoperability and connectivity were important, it established the National E-Health Transition Authority, which has had a very strong focus on developing standards, particularly interoperability standards, which are a crucial part of getting right in the long run. But they haven't focused at all on, I guess, in part because they thought, oh well, getting the standards right is the key, and that's what we should fund. And I think the Boston Consulting Group told them that. I think they've missed the point that if you look at things like the internet, yes, we need interoperability standards at some level, but the real thing that drove the internet revolution is, again, just going back to my old story, it was actually just getting people connected, and you could let the standards come afterwards. You know, you had to get some fundamental standards right, so we actually knew what, you know, we could actually send a message between a hospital and a GP clinical desktop, but you don't really have to get the full picture working. You can do it just as we did with the internet. Get the connectivity happening, and then businesses and other drivers will, you know, will expand that out, and standards will, you know, and then there'll be a greater demand to enforce standards, and that will drive the standard uptake. But so I think the problem at the moment is we've just missed out one big element of what needs to be done, and we've focused too much on this National Health Transition Authority, which I think is great. I think it's a great thing, but people think that's the solution, and it's half of the solution. We've just missed out the other half.
You know, when you talk about the internet, we actually had as a guest on the show here a couple of weeks ago, Vince Cerf, who was one of the co-inventors of TCP/IP, which was the underlying piece of connectivity, I guess, that made the internet a reality. And, you know, it amazes me that more hasn't been driven in this area by the federal and state governments. But I wanted to ask you, are there any global best practices examples? Is there, you know, leaving Australia aside for a second, is any country in the world got e-health operating well in a way that we can look at and emulate?
I think there are some countries have it working pretty well, like some of the Scandinavian countries. Denmark, I think, has fantastic connectivity and sharing of information. The UK, I think, has gone down quite the wrong path. And to give you an example of where I think it's actually a mindset problem, the UK spent hundreds of millions and maybe billions of dollars, I can't remember, trying to, or actually in developing a health appointment scheduling system with the idea that appointments and tracking those are really a very important part of making sure people adhere to healthcare plans and things. And given their importance and given the fact that everyone was using different ones, it was not possible to understand what was happening. So they decided to build this very expensive centralized system and have everyone use that. Well, I think there's better uptake now, but it had been operational for a year, and I think at that point there were 67 people that were using it. And I think while it's much better now, it's still a huge investment, and you've still got only a tiny percentage of people using it. On the other hand, if you start thinking in an internet framework, you'll start saying, well, look, we've already got things like Google Calendar out there. And with Google Calendar, I can set it up to share information across a group of people, such as a care team. And Google Calendar already, you know, sends out SMS reminders and things if I set it up right. So why, instead of building out a huge new appointment system, why don't we just use Google Calendar? And why don't I, instead of trying to get it, have everything, all these systems integrated, why don't I just send an SMS to a to someone who's meant to have an appointment and say, and so look, you're meant to have an appointment in June. Have you made the appointment? You know, key in when that is. If you haven't made the appointment, I'll switch you through to the GP and you can make it now. You know, we could be using a mix of mobile phones and Google Calendars and things that are there already to give us this much more, I guess, distributed information network in health, rather than, for example, the UK is doing, which is to try and centralise everything. So in answer to your question, there are a few countries, as I mentioned, places like Denmark that I think are doing it right. There are places like Canada which have some elements that are working, but by and large, most people are still thinking in that UK model of healthcare.
So just to wrap up then, Mike, if, from a user's perspective, users of the healthcare system, what can we be doing to drive this forward? Is this a dialogue that we should be having with our GP when we see her or him the next time? Is it a dialogue that we should be having with our local representatives? Is there anything that we can do?
As a consumer of healthcare, well, I think there's little to do until you've got the connectivity going, because even if you tell your GP this is, you know, you really should be, you know, just sharing your information with the hospital, etc. There's probably nothing much they can do, except I guess if enough of them get the message, then that will start to flow up and become a real driver. One of the difficulties in healthcare is there often aren't the business drivers for the individuals to do these things. So, for example, for the single GP, for them to send the hospital your health record or health information, or for them to electronically send the pharmacy your health information, is no business benefit to the GP. They don't get paid anything more for it, and so, in fact, an extra cost. So until GPs get the message that, hey, you know, if, you know, the problem is there's no alternative. If there was one GP around the corner who was connected and doing everything electronically, then the thing that consumers could do is to go to their GP and say, look, Fred does this all electronically. It's much better. My health is, you know, everyone that's with him goes to hospital 50% less often than people that are with you. I'm going over to Fred unless you get properly connected. But because no one's connected, there's nothing much that people can do except say, you know, this is something that that we need to move towards. Similarly, when we're in hospitals and we get discharge summaries, I mean, you can say, why don't we send those electronically to the GP? You know, I don't know what that sort of bottom-up, how well that bottom-up pressure can help. But maybe if enough people start to say these things so that the need starts to get recognised.
My only experience with trying to have those sorts of discussions with GPs is when I go in because there's something wrong and they say, what's wrong? And I say, well, according to what I read on WebMD or what I read on Wikipedia, and they get really cranky, I've noticed.
Yeah, that's right. Again, it's because they're not paid. I think in the States, for example, people started sending their GPs emails, which used to drive them crazy. And at least in some regions, they now get paid for responding to the emails, and so it's now actually become something they like rather than dislike. So I think a big part actually is trying to tie in incentives and providers that drive them towards connectivity, and I think that has to be done from above rather than bottom up. But the one thing that consumers can do is, I mean, all of this information about how much worse off everyone is because they don't have connectivity seems to be largely hidden. I mean, most people don't seem to really know that a jumbo jet or two of people die every month needlessly in Australian hospitals. I mean, if we really saw the jumbo jet go down every month, I assume we'd do something about it. But if we really knew that 50% of the people that go to hospital for chronic disease, such as diabetes, really needn't be there, and the only reason they're going in is because we're not connecting up the healthcare team, I mean, maybe someone would do something. But it's just those, you know, that information isn't out there.
Well, it is now. You just put it to a small number of people. Anyway, thanks for coming on the show, Mike. It's been fascinating stuff, and good luck with all of the work that you're doing at Monash to help drive this information and knowledge out into the community.
A pleasure. Good talking to you.